According to CoreLogic, over the last 12 months, their home value index has risen by 30% in Sydney, by 26% in Brisbane, and by almost 20% in Melbourne. Now, there's no doubt that these levels of property price growth, they're unsustainable in the long term. So the question is, are we in a property bubble? Are our property markets about to crash? And if so, when will that happen? Well, that's what I'm going to be discussing in today's podcast with independent financial advisor Stuart Weems, Director of ProSolution Private Client, as we go back in history to see how much property values have fallen in the past. And I think some of the stats Stuart will share with you will surprise you. We're also going to talk about how to protect yourself from a downturn, if and when it comes, and we'll give you some thoughts on that as well. So, welcome to today's show.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropole, who specialize in helping you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now, here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
The average household in a raft of suburbs around Australia is going to be pushed into mortgage stress if interest rates climb just 1%. Well, that was a headline doing the round not that long ago. At much the same time, modelling by one of Australia's most publicised property pessimists, who unfortunately keeps getting his predictions very wrong, yet they keep getting the headlines in the financial press. Anyway, he suggested that a minimum mortgage rate hike, combined with the higher buffers that are now being required by APRA, is going to send thousands of residential landlords into financial stress, and it could fuel house price falls by the end of next year. So will higher inflation really lead to higher interest rates? Will that tip up the scales? Will that spell the end of this current property boom? And more importantly, will it actually create a property market crash like a number of these commentators are predicting? They're some of the topics I'd like to discuss today with independent financial advisor Stuart Weems, founder of ProSolution Private Clients. Now, Stuart's a regular on this podcast, but because I know there's thousands of new listeners every month, I think it's worth mentioning that Stuart's background isn't that he's just a chartered accountant. He's also a financial planner and a mortgage broker. But more importantly, in my mind, Stuart's a successful property investor. And being a thought leader who writes regular columns in the media, he's somebody whose opinions I value. So welcome back again, Stuart.
Hey, Michael. Privileged to be back with you again.
Now, Stuart, I'm getting a sense of deja vu. Every few months, the media seems to find somebody, a property doomsayer, who's prepared to go on a record predicting that the value of the average Australian house is going to plummet and it's going to be the end of the world for property investors. And yet they do this despite the fact that these predictions keep being proven wrong time and time again. Now, sometimes it's those overseas people like Harry Dent who's here to promote his books, but he's been telling us about the global economic crisis and the depression. That's greater than the depression of the Great Depression years ago. But so often they're the local experts who tell us that we're borrowing too much, our debt levels are too high compared to our incomes, property's too expensive. Stuart, that's starting to sound very scary. What are your thoughts about all these things?
Well, I guess firstly, it's not newsworthy unless it's bad news. So I think we've got to keep that in mind, that there might be 10 opinions out there. And of course, the media is going to amplify the two that are most alarming because that's newsworthy. If someone comes out and says, look, property is going to drop by 30%, everyone's interested in that. And that is newsworthy. And of course, it gets more airtime. So I think if we're relying on the media to inform us about, you know, investment decisions and anything we need to be or decisions we need to be making with respect to our own personal situation, well, I would say that's erroneous because they're filtering all the good news out and you're not going to get a sort of balanced view.
The other thing, of course, is that people repeat this and they tell people, their friends, that now that we're actually able to go to barbecues again and get out with other people, they're discussing it. The problem is some people know just enough to think they're right, but not enough to realise that they're wrong.
And, you know, when you look at property prices and how they've performed over the last 40 years, you know, you're excused for disbelieving the growth. You know, just to conceptualise the change in value over 30 years, it looks extraordinary. When you calculate it in percentage terms, it doesn't look out of step with other asset classes like shares and so forth. But when you just look at the raw numbers and say, oh, look, this was $150,000 30 years ago and now it's over $1 million, that seems extraordinary. And it's hard to get our head around those figures just emotionally.
Well, I think back then when you bought your first property, when I bought my first property, one would never have imagined those sort of figures. Just like now, people buying into the properties now at maybe $1 million can't imagine they'd be worth $2 million in 10 years, 20 years' time. Stuart, what about your first property? When did you buy it and how did you feel? Did it seem expensive at the time?
Definitely. So my first property was at 13 Shepherd Street in Moorabbin in Melbourne. I was contemplating at the time, knew, well, I was going to say zero about property, but if you could have negative knowledge, that would be me. And anyway, I was contemplating two properties at the time. One was in a quiet street and one was on a main road, on South Road, actually. And luckily enough, common sense prevailed and I bought the one on the quiet street. It settled in December 1998, so some time ago, for $150,000. It was about 600 square metres. It was a two-bedroom, old 50s-style property that was in disrepair. So it was pretty much all land value. I sold that property in 2001. Because it's subsequently been subdivided, it's hard to find the sales data and I've got to rely on my memory. I sold it for somewhere between $300 and $330. So doubled my money in 3 years. Which is extraordinary, right? In dollar terms, it's commensurate with what happens in the market today, but in percentage terms, it's extraordinary. So $150,000 was a lot of money to me at that time and to the property market. You know, that was probably very close to the median property price in Moorabbin at the time. As I said, that property has subsequently been subdivided. They built two townhouses on it. Each of those townhouses would probably be worth, I don't follow the Moorabbin market very closely, but I would imagine worth, if not $1 million, could be over or at least very close
to it.
It'd
be more than that now, Stuart, because that area is gentrified. There are a lot of older homes there and you got it quite right, despite not knowing what's going on. One of the problems for beginning investors is if they get it right the first time, they think they're smarter than they are. Now, you are smart and I know that, but it often leads you to make other interesting decisions. So at the time, it seemed expensive, just like 20 years or so before that, my first investment property at $18,000, and I was still living at home with my parents, I went halves with my parents to buy that. We took a $16,000 mortgage for 30 years, had no idea how we'd pay it off. Interestingly, I do know what that property is worth, Stuart, because I sold it back to my parents. I bought it back since. Pam and I have built two townhouses, and they'd be worth combined about $2.5 million. So $18,000 to $2.5 million in Larch Street, South Caulfield. I still own my first property. But like you, I made a mistake and I sold it along the way too.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, just look at those raw numbers. But the thing is, every property I have bought, Michael, regardless of its value, I felt a bit sick afterwards. You know, there's never a time when I've really bought a property, or maybe save for one that I bought in 2008 at the height of the GFC. I thought I got myself a pretty good deal, but it was in a landscape of incredible uncertainty. So I really didn't know, you know, necessarily what the future held. I thought I got a good deal compared to pre-GFC, but I didn't know how it was going to all play out. So, but apart from that one, every property I've bought, I've sat back and thought, wow, that's a big price to pay. I hope it's going to work out. And I don't think it's going to change in the future, by the way.
No, I think people have got to accept that. So when you first buy a property, there's no doubt that you've got to stretch. And a lot of people have stretched. There have been all the incentives from the government that have had more people buying properties, first home buyers buying properties, than have happened for decades. And so people are now saying they've bitten off too much. They're going to get themselves into trouble if interest rates rise. I mean, that's a big precedent. We can talk about that in a moment. But what is mortgage stress then? And is it a concern? So I know there's various definitions. How do you see it?
It's funny, Michael, really over the 20 years that I've been in business, I've read various reports and sort of investigative journalism to say these are the mortgage stress levels, et cetera, et cetera. The way that I would measure whether the market is in mortgage stress is bank arrears rates. So arrears means that someone's behind on their loan repayments And then if they get too far behind, the bank will write off the debt, or at least provide for that debt write-off, which and the banks made a lot of provisions, but mainly in the corporate sector last year during the as a result of the COVID lockdowns and so forth. I'd imagine a lot of them are going to be written back because the economy's done pretty well during that period. But if you look at arrears rates, I mean, they did rise a little bit last year, understandably so. People put their mortgages on hold and, you know, lockdowns and those sorts of things. But if you look at arrears rates over a 20-year period, they have been resiliently low, incredibly low. So when people argue, oh, there's mortgage stress, and particularly when people argue there's mortgage stress when interest rates are sub 4% across the board, I mean, I don't think anyone's paying above 4% unless you fixed your rate a long time ago. It's ridiculous. It's insane because incomes haven't changed that much. Unemployment isn't that high and interest rates are incredibly low. So it's impossible that there's mortgage stress. At least there's not mortgage stress to the levels that are going to impact the demand for property, which is not to say that there's some people out there because of the change in personal circumstances that they're struggling. Of course, there's always going to be that cohort, but it's whether that cohort becomes so large that it starts to impact demand, overall demand for property, you know, I think it's ridiculous.
Well, one definition of mortgage stress that a lot of people seem to use is 30% of pre-tax income is spent on home loan repayments, or more than 30%. Now, the underlying premise is that if your debt levels are higher than that, you're going to be struggling to repay the loan. In my mind, that's too broad brush a definition, because does that affect the wealthier people the same as it does people at lower socioeconomic levels? But I think it's those figures that those property pessimists are touting, they're bringing up and saying, aha, see, I told you so. But just because a first home buyer has overstretched themselves a little bit, they're going to eat Maggi noodles. They're not going to let their home suddenly be taken over by the bank, are they?
And that's the thing. That's the biggest thing, the biggest difference between, say, a share versus a home. You know, I can go and sell my stocks tomorrow, and from a practical lifestyle perspective, it's not going to have any impact on me. But if I make a decision to sell my home or even a holiday house and then a little bit below that listed an investment property, it has significant impact. So a home, obviously, if we go and sell it because we're in mortgages, we need to live somewhere. You know, we need to go and rent somewhere or repurchase somewhere else for a lower price or whatever it might be. And even if I decide I'm in a bit of stress, I decide to sell an investment property or contemplate selling an investment property, I know that there's a lot of costs associated with that. I've got to pay selling costs. I've got to crystallize potentially capital gains tax liability. And then I know to repurchase again, I've got stamp duty and all the sort of costs associated with another acquisition. So I'm going to think really, really carefully because of those costs before I go and sell it. Whereas with, as I said, with other investments, well, bang, you can make the decision tomorrow. In fact, at a click of a button, which is a double-edged sword, of course. So this is the thing. When economists sit down and look at macroeconomic data and they model things like interest rates and their potential impact on property prices, that's one thing. That's one sort of analysis. But I think you've got to start to overlay a little bit of behavioral economics, you know, and understand what are people actually doing. And it's probably easier for you and me, Michael, because we're speaking to people that are making property decisions every day. So we get to see the data, the macroeconomic data, and then we get to sort of put that in context with our conversations. Whereas the people, the banks, the economic departments, they don't necessarily have that benefit.
Yeah, they talked about those fiscal cliffs. There was the mortgage cliff. Remember, there was the cliff that was going to happen and we were going to fall over when principal and interest loans became interest-only loans. Anyway, I think I agree with you that the best measure of mortgage stress really is the default or arrears rates for the banks. And currently, very few Australian households are suffering from mortgage stress. In fact, I know many are well ahead of their mortgage repayments. Now, there's no doubt that some people will get themselves into trouble. But when you look at the overall market, to talk about a crash, according to CoreLogic, now the Australian property market, the residential market, is worth $9.3 trillion. Interestingly, Stuart, we both recognise that's gone up from $8 trillion only in March, April this year. That's $1 trillion extra value. But the loans, the outstanding mortgage debt, is only $2 trillion. Now, I say only 2 trillion, but if you take the loan to value ratio over the whole Australian property market, we're at the 22-23% range. So there's lots of people who've paid off their mortgages, others who have paid off half their mortgages. So there doesn't seem to be any cause to be concerned about a general property market crash moving forward.
No, but one thing that has happened, Michael, is household indebtedness has increased significantly. So in dollar terms and relative to household income, you know, if you look at indebtedness 30 years ago, we were borrowing far less. So obviously we can debate whether, you know, that's financially prudent and what impacts that might have ongoing, but I think it's a theme that's been occurring in every developed economy around the world. So it is what it is. But the outcome of it, you're exactly right. It really comes down to income that comes in and money that goes out. And as long as you've got buffers and you've considered what repayments will cost you at 5, 6, 7%, then you're fine. And whilst you might need to make some sacrifices if interest rates get to 7%, you're probably unlikely to get into a situation where you're going to have to sell your property. And I would say that is the vast majority of Australian borrowers think along those lines. The takeaway from the higher indebtedness is that we are far more sensitive to interest rates than we used to be. So as you will recall, Michael, in the early 90s, interest rates got to 18-ish percent, certainly double digits. If interest rates rose to 18% in Australia with the current level of indebtedness, you may as well dig a hole in your backyard and bury yourself because it's all over. So it's never going to get back to that level.
Well, and it's very high as well. So you've got to really talk about real interest rates, don't you, Stuart?
And they were only high for, well, only 9 to 12 months, you know, which is considerable, but they went up very quickly and then down very quickly, or at least normalized to a greater extent. But look, economists are debating what is the neutral interest rate. So what is the interest rate?
So I think we should explain that. So interest rates are stimulatory at the moment. The Reserve Bank has lowered interest rates to stimulate the economy because of the economic challenges we had because of COVID, because we fell into, well, at least it was a technical recession. So what you're now saying is, what do they have to raise them to, not to stimulate, but not to slow down?
Yeah, correct. Most economists are saying it's somewhere in that 4-5% band. That's where mortgage interest rates need to be.
So let's be clear, that's the mortgage rate, not the Reserve Bank cash rate, which is the one that the Reserve Bank has got control over.
Correct. So somewhere between 1% and 2% higher to what they are today. Is that the kind of neutral interest rate? Now, of course, interest rates can rise above that, particularly if the government wants to cool the economy, take some cash out of the economy and so forth. But, you know, I used to, when I did projections, financial projections for clients, I used to assume an interest rate of 7% just because that was really the long-term average leading up to the GFC. And obviously during the GFC, the interest rates were a little unusual. So I sort of looked at that period. I think that's probably too high now. I think in terms of long-term trend, if you can afford debt at 6% and that's affordable, then I don't think you're going to get into too much trouble.
Well, we know the banks have only been lending money to those who could comfortably handle probably a 2.5% increase in the current rate, and now that's changed to an increase of 3%. So newish borrowers have had that stress test put on them already. But I think we also got to understand the only reason the Reserve Bank would raise interest rates would be to slow down a booming economy. At the moment, they're keeping them low to grease the wheels of industry. So for them to raise rates, they'd have to be seeing high inflation. And I know it's crept up a little bit, but not like overseas, and we've got a different market here. And wages would have to increase considerably as well. And while wages have normalized, if we're going to be getting those 200,000 people into Australia, even in the first half of next year, as are now being suggested, that may put a little bit of a damper on wages growth. So I think overall, the Reserve Bank's unlikely to, they don't want our property market to crash, especially before an election. They want that about as much as they want another strain of coronavirus.
Yeah, that's right. And look, people are debating and economists are debating the relationship between interest rates and asset prices. And when interest rates are low, asset prices are higher, and the reverse is true as well. So the argument is that when interest rates rise, asset prices should come down. And I don't argue with that logic from an economics perspective. But I guess what we're saying, Michael, is what is the impetus Because if you're going to see a price drop of 10 or more percent, you need a lot more sellers than there are buyers in the market. So you kind of need a bit of mass selling going on. What is the impetus for people to turn around and wake up one day and go, that's it, I'm selling my home?
Because and fewer people wanting to buy, because you need the combination of both.
Yes, correct. And so what is that impetus? Well, the only thing that can create mass selling, particularly of homes, is if people really can't afford it. But you're right, the banks have been testing affordability at 5.5%. So anyone that's borrowed in the last, let's say, 5 years has probably been stress tested already. And then anyone that hasn't borrowed, that has had a mortgage for longer than 5 years, well, interest rates are 2% higher 5 years ago. You know, so they've already worn that time or been able to afford that time. So it's really just the people where they've had change in circumstances. And I don't think that there's going to be a large enough cohort, particularly if the unemployment rate stays relatively low, or at least doesn't increase from here. I don't think there's going to be a big enough cohort. So, okay, certainly there could be a change in demand for property and people might contemplate, oh, do I want to pay that price for that property? And certainly that could have, and we've seen the property market might lose 2 or 3% in terms of value here and there. That's just a natural course of a market cycle. But for you to get double-digit falls in prices, you really need a lot more people wanting to sell than a lot more people wanting to buy. And I don't understand what's going to create that situation.
Well, you suggested a couple of things that could. So let's just fill that up out a little bit more. To get a true collapse, as we said, you've got to have an extreme external shock of some sort, because people don't sell up their houses easily because they've got to live somewhere, they've got to move somewhere. And remember, investors similarly don't sell up as easily, but they will if they get into some mortgage problems. So you either have to have really, really high employment that's high enough to trigger a wave of forced sales. That's not going to happen. It didn't happen during the downtimes of 2020, so it's unlikely that we're going to have significantly high unemployment. In fact, we know the Reserve Bank's working to do the opposite. The other would be to have interest rates that go up so high that a raft of homeowners would default on their mortgages. And again, you've given a couple of reasons why that's not going to happen. The other is a credit squeeze. I mean, we've had that before, particularly for investors when APRA's got involved and made it more difficult. They're making it a little bit more difficult at the moment, but they don't want the property market to crash. Of course, a severe recession where you've got huge unemployment levels, that could cause homeowners to default. We're not going to have a recession. We know that. The economy is doing well. Or, Stuart, the other big one, I guess, is if there's a huge oversupply of properties, but currently there's an undersupply other than in the CBD, and that could well be taken up over the next year with the opening of our borders again. So I can't see a crash on the cards, but I think we've got to be clear that we do see a correction. It's going to occur one day. The timing of that will be probably when the Reserve Bank starts to increase rates a bit, when APRA interferes a bit more. The banks are now suggesting that could be in 2023. A couple of the big banks have come out with their forecast in the last week suggesting that next year, 2022, is going to be a good year, nowhere near as good as 2021 was. And then depending upon which bank you listen to, they're suggesting that property values are likely to fall in 2023, related to raising interest rates. But obviously, some properties, investment-grade properties, A-grade homes, they're likely to hold their value much better. We saw that last year, didn't we, Stuart, that A-grade homes, investment-grade properties dipped. They dropped 5% or so during the issues of COVID in 2020, but it was B and C-grade properties that suffered more.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, I thought it might be interesting to share this, Mike. I looked at since 1980, I looked in Melbourne, Sydney, and Brisbane, and I identified the largest falls in prices over, well, since 1980, so nearly 40-year period. So I'll just share what I found. Then I can sort of sum it up and tell you what it suggests. So in Sydney, this is just median house data, by the way, but Sydney fell 15% between 2017 and 2019. But the five-year period prior to 2017, prices rose by 13% compounding.
I'd like to put some context to that, because leading up to that, up to 60% of all purchases in Sydney were to investors. It was a boom driven by investors at the end, and that's one of the reasons APRA stepped in and stopped that boom.
Yep. In Melbourne, the largest drop since 1980 was in 2011-2012. And the 2 years prior to 2011, prices rose by 24% per annum. So 2 years, 24%. That's a huge increase in value. And Brisbane's a far less volatile market. Obviously, it's a much smaller market. But in 1986-87, it fell by 8%. But the 5 year period leading to 1986, it rose by 11%. So it shows that if we are going to get a significant correction, and remember, they're the largest sort of corrections over time periods, and they tend to happen gradually. Like, for example, Sydney was over, you know, a 2 or 3 year period, it lost 15%. During that period, it had some positive quarters, but just generally the trend was lower. You need to have experienced above average growth for a period of time, somewhere between 2 and 5 years. If you do experience an extended period of above average growth, then of course there's a chance that there's a correction on the other side. Well, if you have a look at what's happened, certainly this year has been extraordinary in terms of property prices. But if you look at, if you take the context of the last 5 years, which includes some pretty ordinary years in 19 and 20 and so forth, well, the average growth in Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane is somewhere between 5 and 7%. Melbourne did 7%, Brisbane did 5%. And that takes into account the significant growth that's occurred lately. So I think what's happened this year is just a bit of mean reversion, just making up for, you know, previous years that were actually very poor in terms of growth. And we're certainly not in a situation where we've had a period of 5 years of 13% or something like that, and property prices are totally overcooked. So I thought that was interesting just to put that in context of, you know, people talking in isolation about, oh, the property price growth over the last 12 months. But really what you got to do is look at that longer term trend, and that gives you a better indication of where property values are.
And we've seen these long-term trends before also. 2001 to 2008, there was actually a long boom. 2012 to 2017, there was as well. Between those, there was gaps of 3 or 4 years where, in fact, property prices dropped, went up again and remained flat. That's just the way the property cycle works. This seems to be it'll be a shorter cycle. I think we went from the flat time, Stuart, straight into the upturn stage of the cycle rather than the moderating stabilization stage in the middle. We had that big price growth. But it'll be interesting when you look back in 20 years, in 10 years, as we said at the beginning of this chat, that these prices are going to seem cheap in 2031, aren't they?
Oh, definitely. I mean, absolutely, without a doubt. There's a gentleman called Rob Arnott that is the head of a firm called Research Affiliates in the US. He's a share market fundamentalist, so talks about the fundamentals in share markets, and very widely respected, writes a lot of papers, etc. Anyway, I was listening to him, and he was sort of commentating or talking about sort of share markets and so forth. But when I was listening to him, I was thinking, well, this just relates really well to the property market. And he was saying, look, if you want to take a position in the share market, or you want to really work out, you know, how your money should be invested, you really need to be thinking about whether the themes, that the narrative at the moment is going to matter in 5 years' time. And he gave some examples. He said, like, will COVID matter in 5 years' time? No, no chance. Will inflation matter in 5 years' time? No, absolutely not. Will demographics matter in 5 years' time? Absolutely. Right. And so the same sort of advice can apply to investors, but I might extend the period to 10 years because property is obviously a kind of much longer term investment. So what will matter in 10 years' time from now? Will COVID matter? No. Will what happens to prices in 2022 matter? Absolutely not. Will any of these predictions matter? Will interest rates really matter? You know, a lot of the narrative and rhetoric that goes on in the market, the noise, let's call it the noise, a lot of it is actually that useful in helping us inform making decisions. In fact, it will invite you to make a mistake because you'll go, oh, property's going to drop, so I won't buy. I'll wait. And then there'll never be a signal for you to go, oh, yeah, I'll buy now because I'm full of confidence. There'll always be a reason to wait.
Well, at this stage of the cycle, people are thinking, gee, I should have got in a year ago. And the answer is yes, you should have got in 20 years ago if you could. But there are ways of reducing your risk in what's seemingly an expensive market today. And Stuart, that's something that you keep writing about in your blogs, talking about in your own podcast as well. And that's buying the best asset you can.
Yeah, absolutely. Play the long game, which is exactly what I do personally, which is exactly what I advise my clients to do. So don't compromise. Try and find the best possible investment quality property within your budget. Be cognizant of value. You know, you don't want to go out there and overpay. There's no reason to overpay. And when I say overpay, look, property values are so subjective. You know, whether you pay an extra 30 grand, I'm not saying that's suggesting that's overpaying, but you're not going to pay 20% more than what you think the property's worth. That would be stupid, right?
Well, the bank wouldn't let you settle either, would it?
No, that's right. I mean, they'll do a valuation and they'll let you know whether you've, but then by then it's potentially too late anyway. But in any case, it's really about buying the highest quality property. And the reason why is that if you have not a diamond, but a pink diamond, your asset's always going to do well in bad markets, which means it will hold its value and do exceptionally well in buoyant markets. And that's the best way, to my mind, to reduce your investment risk, because that's what really people are worried about is risk. Well, what happens if I buy and property prices drop, or what happens if the market crashes, or these sorts of things? They're worried about things that can go wrong. So if you're worried about things that can go wrong, then try and buy that pink diamond, whatever it is within your budget. So if you've got a budget less than $1 million, you know, instead of buying a two-bedroom apartment, buy a one-bedroom, you know, but a really good, spacious, well-lit one-bedroom apartment. But don't compromise. I went and looked at an apartment in Melbourne yesterday, Michael, in South Yarra. I was contemplating purchasing it, but it had some road noise on the balcony. You know, you could hear some road noise. Now, it was a great apartment, had a lot of great attributes, really well lit. It was a really large two-bedroom apartment, 1950s block, only 6 on the block, probably the best location in Melbourne in terms of area. But it had that attribute of, you know, now you're never going to get a perfect property. All properties have something that you'd change or something you'd like to improve. But there are some fundamentals that you absolutely don't want to compromise on. And to my mind, I'd rather just keep looking. So don't compromise, but don't overthink it as well. Just try and level up on quality, take a long-term approach, and that's really the best way to mitigate most of the risks that we've been talking about.
Well, as we've spoken about before, property investment's part art and part science. So the perspective that you have living in Melbourne, knowing it, knowing that that's a great location and doing the research was valuable, but then you actually got on the ground and you saw that despite on paper that property being a great property, it wasn't. And I think that's one of the reasons you really need a local area expert on your side, especially moving forward. This year, every property did well, secondary locations, main road locations, partly because of FOMO, partly because buyers, home buyers and investors, they didn't do their due diligence right. Some are going to get caught out. They cut corners just to get into the market. But I see moving forward, Stuart, we're going to end up with more a two-tier property market where the more affluent properties in more affluent locations where the demographics can afford to and is prepared to pay more are going to keep rising. While in a lot of areas where properties have gone up a bit over the last couple of years, people's wages haven't gone up. They haven't got more in their pay packet to be able to buy more.
That's right. And can I just reiterate a point that you just made, Michael, which I think is, to my mind, fundamental. And as a business that's not a buyer's agent, you know, as someone that's completely independent, I just want to reiterate it. The way I think about it, when I hire a buyer's agent, what I'm hiring is their experience. Okay, the knowledge too. Knowledge is important, what makes a good investment property, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not underplaying it, but I could reproduce that knowledge if I really wanted to. Spend 6 months really studying, understanding the attributes and fundamentals. Maybe I'm not going to get as close to them, but you know, I can sort of reproduce it. What I can't reproduce is experience and knowledge of the area, the actual geographical location. And so, I think it's a very, very important, regardless of where you're buying, but particularly if you're buying outside your home state, that's exactly what you need to pay for. Really easy to make a mistake, because the property I just spoke about, I went there inspecting as if I'm definitely going to buy this. Like I'm super keen. It ticked every single box. So really you've got to be able, I mean, it makes sense. Don't buy a property sight unseen, of course.
I know you say, of course, some people are suggesting, and they're a bit more quiet on the internet at the moment. No, you don't need to do that because you're going to let your emotions get in the way if you actually see the property. I think that's very poor advice.
Oh, it's rubbish. It's and it will invite you to make a mistake. And case in point, just this week is my real life example of that. So, but if you're hiring a buyer's agent, what you're really doing is hiring that person or that team's experience on the ground, and that's what you're really lending against. You know, you're paying them a fee to borrow that experience, and that's absolutely critical, because if you want to execute in terms of buying a really high grade quality asset, then that's the sort of experience that you need.
Now, one thing we left out when talking about how to protect yourself from the upcoming correction that will happen one day, whatever level of correction is going to occur, and that's having a financial buffer. So when you advise your clients, how do you decide what they should have up their sleeves?
As much as possible would be the overarching theme. Look, the first thing I do, Michael, is I think about, you know, what's the affordability of much higher interest rates? Oh, when I say much higher interest rates, 5%, it's got to be comfortable, 6% at a stretch, maybe 7%, but you've got to make some really significant changes to your spending patterns. That's fine, because I don't think interest rates are going to be above 7% for a prolonged period of time. So really testing that cash flow position. And then also thinking about future expected changes as a result of that as well, if there are any. Typically, starting a family could be a more common one, but obviously if you've already done that or you're not planning to do that, it's not a big deal. The best way to mitigate risk, Michael, is to build, particularly if your equity allows it, build plenty of buffers into loans. So, you know, if I borrow $50,000, $100,000 more than what I need, I can put it back into loan. It's always there that I can access it via redraw. I don't need to pay. It's not going to cost me anything until I need the money, but at least I know I've got a fallback position. And the benefit of that is because property is quite illiquid. You know, if I decide to sell it, I've got to then find an agent, maybe get the property ready for sale, have a campaign, et cetera, then wait for settlement. You know, somewhere, say, let's say 6 months, it's going to take until the money's in the bank. And you might not want to sell in that market. So if I've got 2 to 3 years of negative cash flow, you know, if the property's costing me $20,000 and I've got access to $60,000, for example, $20,000 a year, and I've got access to $60,000, that's 3 years up my sleeve that I can make then a really deliberate decision. Now, I hope I never get there, but you always plan for the worst, hope for the best. I think that's a really good way to look at property and say, okay, I'm going to buy this asset. If things turn really bad, I've got 3 years up my sleeve to maximize my exit price. I fail to see, and looking at historic data, you know, as someone that likes an evidence-based approach, looking at historic data, that would have served you really well over the last 40 years.
Now, clearly you advise your clients with evidence-based approach, but also with your years of experience. So what are the range of services that ProSolution Private Clients offers if people want to speak to you?
Independent financial advice. So we'll sit down and put a plan together. And what we really want to do, Michael, is work with clients and inspire them to adopt a holistic approach. When I say a holistic approach, you know, thinking about the tax considerations, the lending considerations, financial planning, think about insurance in terms of mitigating risk, and have that holistic plan. And so that's it. That's what we're keen to do, is work with clients on a holistic basis over a long term, understand where they're heading, what their current position is, develop a plan, and then help them implement that plan. And of course, navigate the inevitable changes over time, not only in their situation, but markets.
Sure. And as you said a moment ago, since you don't buy property, your advice is independent. And I know that you clearly recommend people use buyer's agent services like a team at Metropole. So I'm going to leave a link in the show notes about ProSolution Private Clients. But I also would think that now with coming up to Christmas and people going to have time to read and to learn and to prepare for what's going to be a slightly more difficult year in 2022, you've written a couple of good books that have actually stood the test of time. Do you want to just quickly tell us about those and how people can get them? And I know you usually offer a special deal for listeners to this podcast.
Well, you've just revealed my Christmas gift to you, Michael, and now it's not going to be a surprise. So two of my most recent books, Rules of Lending Game, which takes people through how to structure an investment property portfolio from a lending perspective in terms of products and structure and tax and those sorts of things. So that's rules of the lending game. And my favorite book, of course, is Investopoly. And that's more of a holistic book that sets out 9 rules that people can employ or abide by to ensure that they make the right financial decisions and certainly avoid making financial mistakes. And if you just go to prosolution.com.au, and you use the code Yardney, so your surname, it will reduce the price to $20, no postage. Of course, we're relying on Aussie Post there, by the way, so you'll probably get the book in 2023, but, you know.
Well, I'd recommend it, and I think especially Investopoly, which we've discussed and pulled apart in this podcast before, those rules have stood the test of time. And when many people in 2021 have let some of the rules go by the wayside just to get into the market, I think moving forward, this is really going to be the time where you can't take those sort of chances. So, Stuart, I'm looking forward to a great year ahead in property in 2022. I'm also looking forward to catching up with you regularly on this podcast. But for people who like podcasts, I'm also going to leave a link in the show note for your Investopoly podcast, because that's one you do on your own every week and you write columns in various media, including Property Update. So look forward to having another great year together with you in 2022, Stuart.
Thanks, Michael. Super excited for 2022, particularly hopefully with the absence of COVID. It should be a far more enjoyable year.
Well, I know we've both and our families have missed the travel. So we were speaking before about looking forward to actually not just travelling locally, but getting overseas. So it'll be a great year.
Can't wait.
Just following on with my chat with Stuart a moment ago, I still see good, strong fundamentals for property in 2022, but not for all properties. As I said in my chat with Stuart, it's going to be a two-tier market. We can't have the strong growth that we had in 2021. But if you think about it, the vaccine rollout has proceeded faster than most anticipated, and this has brought forward the reopening of our economy in Australia. It's providing confidence for our property markets. And then, of course, there's going to be the reopening of our borders, bringing lots more people back into the country, skilled visa migrants as well as students. That's going to help our economy and our property markets as well. So moving forward, the combination of low interest rates and pent-up demand is going to help drive increased spending on all sorts of goods, including property. You see, Australians are wealthier than they've been before the pandemic. In general, household savings rates are high, and Australians have hoarded, well, there's different estimates, but up to $75 billion worth of cash in banknotes alone. Apparently, the number of banknotes circulating in the economy is doubled over the last decade. It's gone up 20% since the pandemic, so people are stashing their cash somewhere. Anyway, I still see a good year in property, but you can't just buy any property in 2022 and hope for it to go up. As Stuart said a few times in our chat, you need the best assets. He talked not just about a diamond, but a pink diamond. I guess his wife got into his ears. And as I said, we're in for a two-tier property market moving forward. While most property markets performed really well this year, it's important to realise that won't be the case next year. Not all markets are going to continue growing strong moving forward. Properties located in the inner and middle ring suburbs, particularly in gentrifying locations, will outperform cheaper properties in outer suburbs. So you may be thinking, hey, Michael, I can't afford those areas. Well, there's lots of property markets around Australia. You may not be able to afford Melbourne or Sydney, or you may not be able to afford a house. But what you have to be able to afford to make sure that you don't make a mistake is getting correct advice. Let me explain to you that the most expensive advice you're going to get is free advice that's incorrect. So why not have a chat with my team at Metropole to help you put a strategic plan together to understand if what you're currently doing is going to get you to where you want to go, or if you aren't currently investing, what you have to do to get into the market and where you're most likely to outperform the averages and not make the mistakes that other investors make. In general, we help our clients fix their problems because some have come to us with underperforming properties. We help our clients prevent problems by correct property selection, correct finance solutions, correct asset protection structures. We help our clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth, outperforming the markets using structures, strategies, frameworks that are known, proven, and trusted. Go to metropole.com.au, leave us your details, and I look forward to being part of your ongoing wealth creation journey. By the way, we help mainly experienced investors, but we love helping beginners get into the property market. We don't want you to make the mistake so many others do.
Now here's Michael's mindset message. Remember, a change in your thinking will lead to a change in your life.
In my mindset message today, I'd like to ask you a question. How many good summers do you have left? Now, this change in season that we're experiencing is a welcome reminder that we're not living in a never-ending now. Time marches on and waits for no one. So whether you find yourself on your way into or out of another summer, it's a good time to reflect on the shortness of time. At this time of the year, we tend to ponder about the year that's been and start thinking about our aspirations for what lies ahead. We're roaring into the next year. And while the days may feel long, the years, boy, are they short. So maybe let me ask you another question. What is wealth? A simplistic definition of wealth is the amount of money that you've got access to. But this unfortunately traps many people into spending their finite time to accumulate as much money as they can. Now, I know I talk a lot about money and properties and wealth in this podcast, and that's why I have these mindset messages with you every session as well, to balance things out. Because, as I said, chasing money unfortunately traps many people into spending their finite time to accumulate as much money as they can. And we know that money has value, and wasting it seems silly, but we all throw away something far more valuable every day. Time. One of the few truly finite resources, the amount of time we get, it's uncertain, but we do know it's limited. So those who attain monetary wealth realize, sometimes too late, that real wealth is the ability to spend the money to buy time. We find meaning in being able to spend time on our terms, doing things we love and doing things that bring us joy. One of the few benefits of the pandemic that we've gone through is it's forced us to spend time differently, very differently how we used to. It's given us a valuable opportunity to recalibrate how we view the trade-off between time and money. Okay, time's an abstract concept, difficult to get our heads around at times. One exercise that'll bring it to life is to consider how many specific events or seasons you may have left. How many books will you realistically still be able to read? How many holidays do you have left to enjoy with your parents or your children? How many good summers do you have to look forward to? Ones where you're healthy enough to enjoy it. You see, when you really reflect on how much quality time we have left, we're mostly caught in the hustle and bustle of life. Whilst the time we've got left is limited, there is enough of it to give us a meaningful life if we use it wisely and we're conscious of how much of it we've got left. I read recently that the Roman philosopher Seneca wisely said, "It's not that we have a short space of time, but that we waste much of it. Life is long enough, and it has been given in sufficiently generous measure to allow the accomplishment of the very greatest things if the whole of it is well invested." Now, isn't that interesting? Because if you get emails from me, you'd know that at the end of my emails, I usually write something like, "Spend your time wisely." So, how many good summers do you have left? Spend this summer wisely. As we come to the end of another show, I'd like to remind you of my quest in making as many Australians, and in fact, people all around the world, because we have listeners to this podcast in lots of countries. We rank really high in Kazakhstan. I don't know how many English-speaking people there are there, but I can see that we're amongst the top business and investment podcasts there. So I guess my aim is to make as many people as financially fluent as possible to help them have better lives. And my request to you is just help one person this week by telling them about the Michael Yardney podcast. Share the experience that you're getting if you got some benefit from it. I'll be back again real soon. You can catch me in between. Just look for me on social media or join my private Facebook group where every day I leave some tips, some information to help you. I'll be back again real soon, as I said, but in the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney podcast, which was brought to you by Metropole, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropole to help you?